welcome to the Motion Show. Hello, I'm Phil Hammond, and this is the show where our speakers have to prove they could persuade you of anything. They might convince you that Pamela Anderson is an actress, Ian Paisley is a pacifist, or even that Jeffrey Archer is a novelist. No, perhaps that is stretching a bit, so let's meet our panellists. First up, two regulars who either must really enjoy the show or are desperately short of beer money, Giles Brandreth and Arthur Smith, and next to them, two motion show virgins, Jeremy Hardy and Hugh Dennis. Ladies and gentlemen, the speakers! Let's kick off in the time-honoured fashion with some fantasies. Jeremy Hardy, what would your dream motion be?
This House believes that all Home Secretaries who are descended from asylum seekers should be forced to live on vouchers instead of cash.
Arthur.
This House believes... This House would like to turn Michael Portillo's house into a gay and lesbian drop-in centre.
I think you're too late, Arthur. Hugh, in an ideal world, a world where novelty ties never existed, what would your dream motion be?
This House would peg the earnings of Radio 4 comedians to the salaries of the Manchester United first team.
Finally, Giles, what gets your juices flowing
this
week?
Well, of course, I'm of an age when my dream motion would involve a high-fibre breakfast. But that said, I would love to see us debate the following. This House would like to see the return of all live radio. Because it was so much more exciting in those days. I began as an actor, you know, 30 years
ago. Look, Giles, it's meant to be a motion, not a bloody long speech.
This is a sentimental anecdote.
Oh, well, right. I'll doze off.
About 30 years ago, I began as an actor in this very hall that was then a studio for live drama. And the first part I played, this is quite true, was a young detective. And I had just one line. I came onto the stage and I said... That was the chair Schmidt sat in when he was shot. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work. But it was fun at the time.
Thank you,
I've got another one. I'd like to say this House would like to make futons illegal. They're so stupid, aren't they, futons? If you want a futon, all you got to do is put an old duvet on an ironing board. And you've got a futon.
It's all been very revealing and somewhat disturbing, a look into the minds of our speakers, but without further ado, on to our first motion. This House believes the book is dead.
This House, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, Your Majesty, believes that the book is dead. I should like to consider this proposition from a number of angles. First, from just over here. Then I'm going to move round here and consider it. And finally, I shall return to the podium. This book is dead. Pedants amongst you, and as I look around these shining faces, I see there are a number of them, must concede this. A cat is alive. Obviously, a book is dead. It's made from dead trees. It's dead, all right? But, as second-rate comedians say when they haven't got a laugh, seriously, folks.
Write it down, Charles.
People may wish to still read books, but henceforth it will be done in an entirely different way. I myself am currently reading a novel on a computer. Yes, I've rested the book on top of the computer. Well, my table's a little bit low, you see. Good riddance to books, I say. They're stupid, heavy, cumbersome things. The last 8 times I went on holiday, I took War and Peace with me, and I never read one word of it. And I always run out of pants. Yeah. I just heard a woman say, yeah, I do too. No doubt my distinguished opponent will drag up their old sore about you can't take a computer to bed with you. Well, oh, I say, you can't take Julie Christie to bed with you, but it's worth a try. So, books will cease to exist. Furthermore, I put it to you, book-length chunks of prose will no longer happen. People don't have time. They're too busy surfing porn websites. Books, newspapers, magazines, walnut whips are all going to be replaced by the internet. And with artificial intelligence, which is coming soon, we will Is that just you agreeing or suddenly remembering a girlfriend from 1950?
point of information, Chair.
Yes, sir, Mr. Hardy.
If you get tired or you want a break from reading on a computer screen, you can't fold down the corner of the page except using a blowtorch to melt the screen and then whack it with a hammer with a hanky round it so it doesn't crack.
Do you know, Jeremy has convinced me that I'm talking rubbish. But I was anyway, so that's all right. You see, artificial intelligence, we'll all be the slaves of computers in the end. We won't be allowed to read because computers won't let us. Computers won't be able to read because they haven't got arms. And since I'm getting slightly out of control, in traditional fashion, I'd like to close with a song. Books are bad books, I put it to you, are dead. Thank you.
Thank you, Arthur Smith. Just to prove the book isn't, in fact, dead, I have a selection here of bestsellers. I'm going to read the first paragraph from one of them. I've chosen at random. Here is the ball. Look at the ball. The ball is round. Look at the round ball. And David Beckham's autobiography is available from all good booksellers. Giles.
Thank you.
But seriously, it's your chance to... it's your chance to stick up for bookworms. I call on you to oppose the motion. This House believes the book is dead.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the book isn't dead. If you've been into the beautiful seven-story Waterstones on Piccadilly, or Borders on Oxford Street, the gap for books, you'll know that books have never been so popular or so exciting. Arthur, bless him, is simply out of touch. What he told us of War and Peace illustrates that he doesn't realize that the classics are not what they were. It's all changed. On my bedside, I have got the lunch pack of Notre Dame. Victor Hugo's startling tale of a group of insane gourmets who decide to eat themselves to death within the sacred precinct of Notre Dame, complete with recipes. Arthur should try reading Our Mutual Fiend, a story in which a schizophrenic vampire terrorizes Dickens' London. Books are what introduce children to the whole world of adventure and learning. Think of what little Harry Potter has done, getting children interested in books and reading and black magic. It opens a whole world to young people. The computer will never replace the book. Unlike a computer screen, it's very rare that a book gives you a migraine. There's no need to scroll down. A good book will never go down on you. Consequently, I recommend that we reject Arthur's ignorant and vulgar presentation of his motion and instead go home and open a good book like Enema, arguably Jane Austen's finest work.
Thank you very much. Charles Brandon. There's actually a special name for people who spend their lives trying to track down rare books. They're called teachers. Jeremy, is the book dead? Should we be all web browsers instead of book borrowers?
Well, I think the internet really is just there to service men who want to download from their laptop. And I have to say that the great thing about a library book is it's something you can keep. Something to treasure and enjoy. And in fact, you can build up quite a library at home. Especially if you are able to get hold of a mobile library. And of course, the great thing about one of those is it enables you to bring hundreds of books home at once. Have a place to store them and take them with you when you move.
Thank you. And on that note, I think it's time to put it to the vote. We'll use our personal interaction meditation poll, or PIMP, for short. Those in favour of the motion, this House believes the book is dead, say aye. All those against the motion, say nay.
Nay.
A resounding success for Giles Brandreth.
Thank you.
It's time to move swiftly on to our next motion. This House wants to live in the 60s. Arthur, you're up again. Can you float up to the lectern and propose the motion? This House would like to live in the 60s.
Well, you know, the 60s. The 60s. 10 years of dancing, sex and drugs prevented me from experiencing it. Yeah, there's a well-known saying that if you can't remember the 60s, then, no, I can't remember. Something about that. The 60s. Groovy, fab, and Tony Blackburn. In music, the 60s gave us the greatest, most influential, seminal pop band there's ever been. Pickety Witch. The streets were much cleaner in the 60s because they were swept daily by the bottoms of thousands of voluminous flared trousers. In the 60s, we had passion. We had idealism, we danced naked, we smeared ourselves in porridge and sang. And now we watch gardening programs. Now we're skint and ugly and we have to vote Conservative. Bring back the 60s! Thank you!
Thank you very much, Arthur Smith. Mr. Hugh Dennis, it's your turn to oppose caftans, miniskirts and bubble cars. I call on you to oppose the motion. This House wants to live in the 60s.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I think Mr. Eric Burdon and his animals had it right when they said, we've got to get out of this place. It's the last thing we ever do.
Point of information.
Yes.
If it's the last thing we ever do.
That's true. I missed that bit out. And that's how I feel about living in the 60s. Come on, why? You want to know, well, what has the 60s got to recommend it? All right, conceded. It was the age of the white heat of technology, an era when Britain led the free world against oppression, an era in which Britain was hip, when Britain led the world of fashion. The age of Connery and Kane, of the Ipcress file and Goldfinger, the Italian job and Dr. No, or era of World Cup triumph of the Beatles, of Woodstock, moon landings, sexual revolutions. But apart from that... Apart from that, what is there to recommend it? Let me tell you how it really was. I lived through 8 years of it. It was an age in which the world laughed at us for the invention of the hovercraft, a boat in a skirt that would solve the world's marine transport problems as long as the sea was as flat as a mill pond, the wind was less than a knot, and you didn't mind the persistent smell of vomit. It may have been the age of the Mini, but it was also the age of the Austin 1100. Worse still, it was the age of the Austin Maxi, possibly the least stylish vehicle ever to grace a British road. It looked like the kind of car you built out of Lego when you were seven, but not quite as well put together. Development work began on the Maxi in 1965, at which point it was hoped that it would go 0 to 60 by 1971. A target he'd only just missed. Furthermore, ladies and gentlemen, it was the decade in which Jimmy Hill was a young man and had his whole career ahead of him. Now I see I have your attention. Yes? This may seem like a fatuous point, but I think it was Milan Kundera in The Unbearable Lightness of Being who said that life is only bearable because it's linear. But it could have been me. It was very late. And we never have to go through the whole thing twice. And here lies my strongest suit. For living in the 60s must inevitably be followed by living, yes, in the 70s. Listen if you can stand it. Ladies and gentlemen, between 1970 and 1977, the Bay City Rollers were in the top 10 for a total of 113 weeks. As strong an argument for devolution as I have ever heard. Away from sport, I take you to Mexico City in 1970 and the abject surrender of a two-goal lead to West Germany in the World Cup finals. The culprit, Peter the Cat Benetti, so-called because he slept a lot.
It has to be mentioned that the 70s were a fantastic time to be at school because everybody was on strike all the time. You couldn't get to school. The train drivers are out, the bus drivers are out, there were power cuts in the middle of lessons, halfway through assembly, the miners would bring the government down, it would turn into a polling station. It was fantastic.
That is true, but I would ask, do you want power cuts, medallions, Gareth Hunt, or piss-poor hair? Do you want to be a teenager again and have to practice kissing a melon you've daubed with lipstick?
missing a melon, you've got.
Now we're talking. Wow. The whole show's picked up all of a sudden.
Perhaps that was just me, but ladies and gentlemen, I leave you with just one thought. The spirit that infused the 60s was one of hope, of moving away from austerity to a new future, of looking ahead to what might be achieved. To want to live in the 60s, sitting here now, is to defeat that very spirit. It's a complicated point and not very funny, but worth making. Don't look back. To look backwards is to stand still or to risk serious head injury if you're on an uneven pavement. Look forward. Enjoy now. Enjoy the whatever we're going to call this decade, and we must sort that out. We can win the World Cup if we improve our training methods and we play it at Wembley without any opposition. Michael Caine is still working and Rover are bringing out a new Mini. I urge you, reject the motion.
Thank you very much. You did it.
May I just say that kissing the melon first is the mark of a gentleman.
I would make the hole with my tongue.
Charles, where do you stand on this?
Well, my great tragedy, of course, is that I was around in the 1960s and can remember it all with alarming clarity.
Did you inhale?
Clearly not. Didn't even sniff around the melons. Most people, of course, only remember the good things, you know, the music, the free love, the perfumer affair. But actually, if you have ever smelt a hippie, you will know we are better off now.
Did you, Giles, have long hair in the 60s?
I had hair. That in itself is a sentimental moment in my life. And it did, actually, it flowed long and it was really rather lovely. If you'd known me then, Arthur, things might have been different.
I used to have a moustache and I used to regularly shave it off and smoke it in those days.
Another argument for living in the 60s, yes. Carry on.
Well, no, that's hardly worth carrying on, but he's actually reminded me that I did have a problem with my hair in the 60s. Because I was quite young, and I had no hair on my chest.
Right.
And this
you have now?
Not necessarily a problem.
Well, it was for me. I felt that was wrong, and I sent off for a chest wig. I don't know why I'm sharing this with a wider
That's very interesting.
It came complete with matching underarm toupees.
It's a finely balanced debate that would take the wisdom of Solomon to settle, so we'll resolve it in the usual way by shouting, all those in favour of the motion, this House wants to live in the 60s, say aye.
Aye.
All those against, say nay.
Nay.
A resounding victory for you, Dennis. Our next motion is, this House would like to be an artist. Mr. Hardy can ask you to approach the easel and sketch out the case for the proposition. This House would like to be an artist.
Chair, comrades, I propose a motion. This House would like to be an artist. And tonight, Matthew, I would like to be Rembrandt. Because the thing about being Rembrandt is you get to live in Amsterdam, a city with a fully integrated public transport system, and yet small enough to get round by bike or even on foot. Not only that, Amsterdam has wonderful Indonesian restaurants. Indonesian people supplied not by British aerospace, but by the islands which Holland colonised before they were too out of it to keep an empire together.
Point of information here.
Oh, yes, Mr. Yeah.
Jeremy seems to be on just a minute here.
Mr. Hardy, do you care to respond to that allegation?
Well, I'm in Amsterdam, so I might as well deviate, let's be honest. Let us face it, what better city to live in for an artist, apart from Paris, which is expensive? The great thing about Amsterdam for an artist is you have museums. You have the Rijksmuseum, which is the National Museum of Holland, the Stedelijk Modern Art Museum, and, of course, the Van Gogh Museum. Van Gogh being bugger lugs.
Sorry. Point of information. How would you have the Van Gogh Museum if you are Rembrandt? Rembrandt predeceased the birth of Van Gogh.
I'm telescoping events for effect.
You're living in the future.
I'm a modern kind of guy.
It's fine.
So artists are supposed to be eccentric and transcend different epochs, as I'm doing now. Many people say, but Van Gogh was a gagging looper. And I say, yeah, but you're supposed to be a bit nutsy if you're an artist. The great thing about being Rembrandt is your own house is a museum.
which means you have free entry to a museum 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and you have a constant stream of visitors, making you into a kind of performance artist. Performance art being sort of give us a clue with funding. So, in short, Chair, I think it's ruddy great to be an artist, and I move. Bless you.
Thank you very much. Jeremy Hardy. When Pablo Picasso first told his mother he wanted to become an artist, she laughed. But when he did a portrait, she was laughing on the other side of her face. Mr. Dennis, it's your turn to oppose the Bohemian Rhapsody that this house would like to be an artist.
The place of art in the society in which we live is a subject of very great debate. For example, many tend to the view that the relationship of major artists to the world from which they have sprung and which they sought to change has been complex and indeed stormy. For these people, for example, the 19th century notion of industrial perfectibility bears fruit in the art of Braque, Delaunay, Leger, Picasso, as well, of course, in the mechanosexual metaphors of Duchamp. I myself do not buy into this paradigm. I tend rather to the view that this is pants. Please look at the evidence. Artists will do anything to get attention. Salvador Dali, a talentless Spaniard who couldn't even draw properly, relied for his fame on a ludicrous waxed handlebar moustache. Michelangelo, who, fair enough, did a fairly good job on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, although I note they're constantly having to restore it. Probably something to do with the fact he didn't use enough primer or didn't put enough time into preparation. He was so publicity obsessed that he stipulated in his will that 25% of UK hairdressing salons had to be named after him. But these pale in comparison with Van Gogh. We've already heard one theory about Van Gogh, but for me, he was a typical artist, never bought around, had so few mates, he had to paint the same pot of sunflowers 7 times just to give himself something to do. Vincent van Gogh became so obsessed with fame that he chopped off his own ear as a PR stunt. Apparently, it was originally meant to be a mock kidnapping thing, but he had no mates to send them the ransom note to. I urge you, reject this motion.
Thank you very much. Hugh Dennis. In 1997, the £22 million Van Gogh painting of the sunflowers was exposed as a fake. It was the grow bag that gave it away. Arthur, do you have an artistic bent?
In a way, rather than be a starving artist, better be an art dealer, I would say. You can make a lot of money out of art. I remember I was in Florence a while back, and I bought a little painting in a gallery there, and I took it home, and I thought, I've got a feeling this is worth something. And I took it home and I showed it to a dealer, and he said, there's some good news here. He said, this is a genuine Pandolino from his Venetian period. The bad news is that Pandolino is a plumber. But, you know, the thing that I'm a bit disappointed that neither speaker brought up conceptual art.
Well, I'm a great believer in installations because these days, I mean, they just dump the washing machine off and they don't plumb it in for you, do they? But I did have a slight problem with Tracy Emin's bed because I think, you know, if people are paying and making an effort to come and see you, should make the bed, shouldn't you? You should wash the sheets, so you should tidy. I think Arthur was telling us about his dealer, and I think you've got to realise about your dealer that the reason he's dealing is he's feeding his own habit, and you probably shouldn't necessarily take his word for it, you know, on matters of aestheticism.
You know, it's conceptual, right? Why don't we all take our clothes off now for the rest of this programme?
Because it would be a very unpleasant sight, and I wouldn't.
We now know why we shouldn't all take our clothes off for the rest of the
program. They always make that joke on radio, but I'd like to assure listeners at home that both Jeremy and I have genuinely taken our kit off.
Yes. All those in favour of the motion that this house would like to be an artist, say aye.
Aye.
All those against the motion this house would like to be an artist, say nay.
Nay.
A resounding victory for you, Dennis. It's not over yet. It's time to lock the studio exits and call for security as we charge headlong into the fun-size round where we've shrunk the debates down to one line only. Speakers, get ready. This house believes that he who hesitates is lost.
No. He who ends up in Peckham is lost.
Here, he who hesitates is lost, but he who levitates will know where he is by rising above the level of the surrounding buildings.
This house believes that the child is the father of the man.
Only in some of the more remote parts of Norfolk.
If the father is a child of the man and the daughter is the sister of the woman, who is the cousin of the mother? And that's a question for fathers and older sons only.
I have to say, Dr. Phil, that yes? I don't think I've ever sat for so long next to a totally naked man.
Oh, come off it, you're a Tory!
Funny enough, you know, the rest of your body is much younger than your face.
Hey. This house believes that when in Rome, you should do as the Romans.
Spit a lot and ride a Vespa.
But when in Tenerife, you should shout loudly until you get some service.
This house believes that when in Rome, you should do as the Romans do and never, ever bring gladiators back.
Well, I was in Rome, I thought, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, so I built an aqueduct. And
no, Rome wasn't built in a day. It would have been, but the plasterer was on another job.
You know that other phrase, all roads lead to Rome? I think that all roads roam to Leeds.
We've reached the end of the show. It's time to declare a winner using...
Can I put my clothes on
no,
now?
Yes, you can. No, no. Not until you stood up.
And so we've reached the end of the show. It's time to declare a winner using the time-honoured formula of points scored multiplied by size of prostate gland. And this week's winner is Hugh Dennis. Thanks to our worthy losers for taking part, and thanks also to our studio audience for using their votes with such tact, discretion and blind prejudice.
Doctor.
For Arthur Smith. Yes?
Before we go, can I ask something? You're yes? a medical man. Is it customary for middle-aged men to have stretch marks?
Three children I've had.
Unfortunately, Mr. Smith is one of my patients, so I don't feel I should speculate on that. And finally, the answer to one of life's great mysteries, why did Sellafield get a nuclear processing plant and Greenwich get the Millennium Dome? Because Sellafield had first choice. Good night. The Motion Show was hosted by me, Dr. Phil Hammond. I was joined by Hugh Dennis, Jeremy Hardy, Charles Brandes and Arthur Smith. The executive producer was Bill Dare. The program associate was Simon Blackwell. And the producer was Adam Bromley.